As we said before, we'll take, hopefully, a little time each class and give somebody an opportunity to talk about their conversion. Anybody that's not done that that would like to do that this evening? 2, 3, 4 minutes, how you became a Christian? Okay, let's dig into the material then. This is entitled Fight or Flight. He mentions that it's helpful to continue to memorize some passages. We've not made that a condition of the class, but it can be very, very helpful. He mentions to research Luke chapter 8, verses 1 through 15. This is one of the three places where we have the parable of the seed, the parable of the sower. He asks, what are the four types of soil represented? Now, you could look at this in two different ways. I have both in the material that I've written here. How would you, as far as identifying them, how would you list them? We could list them as far as the soil. That would be one way to go. What would one of the four soils be? There was the... All right, there was the wayside, there was the hardened soil, think of concrete or asphalt, and then something that's not quite as bad. What do we have next? There's the rocky soil, so you'll find some soil mixed in there. And then you have a lot more soil, but what's the problem with the third one? You have the thorns in that one, and then number four, you get to the soil, which is good soil. Now, one of the soils you have, as far as the first one, the hardened soil, the concrete soil, what happens there? People... They hear, but what's the problem? It doesn't take root because who shows up? The devil. And what's he do? Hardens her heart. He steals away the word. So that doesn't last very long. Then we come to the rocky soil. What happens there? Jesus said they do what with the word? They receive it with joy. So that does take root, but it doesn't last. It eventually dies. Then we come to the thorny ground. What happens? Starts to grow, just like your garden. Plant the seeds. Everything is going great. And you think, well, we're going to have some nice squash and watermelon and carrots and cucumbers and all these great garden products. But what happens? Go on vacation and get busy and you come back and what do you have in your garden? You've got a weed patch, not really a garden anymore. I think most of us have either had that experience or we've seen it. And what happens? The weeds, they choke out the good stuff. And that happens when we think about the cares and the riches of the world. But then number four, what happens? We have good ground. And that's what we're talking about when we come to the book. Now, if you are familiar with our Lord Let Me Grow free Bible study program, I don't know if Betty picked up on this or not when she processed the contact. But very, very interesting. The last contact that we received a few days ago, it came from a governor's office. I don't know who in the governor's office signed up for that course. But whoever it is, maybe it's a low-level staffer, maybe it's a personal assistant to the governor, I have no clue. But whoever it is in that governor's office, they have an email address that has the governor's URL/domain attached to it. And I thought, how interesting. Now, whether that will go anywhere or not, I don't know. But it gives you one more idea as you think about the parable of the seed. We're trying to sow in all kinds of places. And Paul talked about Caesar's household, house to house. Remember the graphic that we had up some years back? It said from our house to the White House. There were some people like Colin Powell and some others that were looking at that material. So you never know where those seeds are going to go. Carol had sent off the book to Zuckerberg. So again, it doesn't hurt to sow those seeds. Pray that God will allow them to come to fruition. Sometimes they're out there on the parking lot and they're not going to go anywhere. But sometimes you just never know. So we plant, we try to water, God gives the increase. Dan?
Well, I've heard this question a lot of times. How long do you stick with the prospect? How long do you continue to try to teach, encourage? How long do you stick with them? And we all know someone, I think, who it seems as if you're there on a daily or every other day or every third day basis, encouraging them, et cetera, then they'll stick with it. But it reminds me of the rocky soil. Because if you take rocky soil, it does have some soil mixed with it, and it will grow a crop if you water and feed it well enough. If you stick with it, if you're there constantly to make sure that it continues to grow, it will grow a crop. But these people who are that you have to constantly be with, constantly encourage, constantly whatever, if you think of the fact that maybe you're working with rocky soil, it might help you to figure out just how long to stay with it.
Okay, you made some good statements. You also asked a question. So, did you answer your own question, or do you want us to explore that question a little more?
I'm sorry, I got lost somewhere. What question did I ask?
Well, I think the question was, how long do you stick with it?
Then
you sort of answered your own question. But
I guess I was saying, for individuals who run into somebody like that, they might be asking themselves the question, how long do I stay with them?
Okay.
So if you want to explore that, fine.
But I think you did a good job as far as answering your own question. But let me take Jesus' illustration and put it in terms that you might not have ever have considered. Let's look at it from not a spiritual perspective, but let's look at it from a secular perspective. Let's look at it from the perspective of getting a job. You think you could show up at an employer's doorstep and find somebody who is like the good soil? He says, we're looking for somebody. Come on in. We've got good benefits. We'll hire you on the spot. And we think, wow, that was so great. Do you think you'll find some people at the other end of the stick? What's the opposite of the good soil? No, it's not just rocky. It's the wasteland. It's the concrete. You can knock on that door from here until you've lived 10 lifetimes, and you're not going to get the job. You can beg and plead and cajole, and you're not going to get hired. And then you sort of have in between. You get persistent enough. Now, here's what I was kind of thinking when you got to the end of that. You want a job at place X. You want to convert person Y. How long do you work the job, potentially, possibility, at place X?
How bad do you want the job?
Well, that's part of the answer. But it's going to be, in some respects, a somewhat subjective decision. You're going to say, okay, I can't do this forever, but I really like to work there, so I'm going to pursue that job for maybe a month actively. I'm going to maybe call them every day. Sometimes people have gotten jobs that way, or at least I'm going to check in a couple times a week or at least once a week, and if after a solid month I don't have any leads, it doesn't look like the door's opening, I'm going to shut that down. Now, if you really want to work in that place, might you say, it's not working out right now, but I'm going to keep that in my mind, and maybe in 6 months or a year or 5 years or even 10 years, maybe I'll retire and get a job there. And I think if you can look at the employment strategy that some people use sometimes, you can put that into the same category as evangelism. We're going to spend some time with this guy, whether it's a week or a month or whatever it might be, and if it works out, fantastic. If it doesn't, then we're going to start easing back a little bit. And if it looks like we have the kind of soil that Jesus described where there's no hope, we're going to completely back off. But other people, we might say, we're going to make them a longer range project. So we do the same thing in some other areas of life. And if we'll take what we do almost automatically in those realms and apply that spiritually, I think that will be of great benefit to us. So good point, good thoughts. That's my addition. Anybody else? Ray?
Speaking of the workbook, then, we see Randall, we see Mike in there. And Randall is not really pursuing, pushing him at all.
Right.
He's just putting feelers out there and letting Mike take the bait, I guess.
Yeah.
Say. But it took him time to do that. And I think that's what we can do in a lot of cases. We may not be able to get a Bible study with anybody in quite some time. But eventually, if you just let them know you're still interested in things, you can come around.
Jesus said, I'm going to make you fishers of men. It would be nice. I fish some, and I'll tell you, it would be really nice if you would go out and just first cast. As soon as the lure hits the water, as soon as the bait hits the water, I mean, you reel in a big one every time. I'd love to fish like that. But you know, it just doesn't work like that. And even if you watch a fishing show on TV, imagine how many hours of footage they have to go through that the guy's catching one every third or fourth or fifth cast. He might be out there a month. I don't know how long it takes, but I imagine he's out there probably at least a few days so they can get their 30 or 40 minutes of film in. And it's that patience that you're going to have to invest in a person and let some time pass. But oftentimes you want those immediate results, whether it's fishing or whether it's food or, you know, even house cleaning. You know, it'd be nice if you just shake the dust rag and it's all done, but it doesn't work like that.
But, you know, even like Mike Randall there, that doesn't mean we should be looking somewhere else.
Yes, and that's why I say the job prospect, I think, is really good. We'll pursue this to the best of our ability, but if it looks like it's not going to open up anytime soon, we will have to explore some of the possibilities. So, great thoughts.
Well, we know from the book that Randall was also working with Larry
yes.
at the same time. So, I mean, in that same time frame that they were, he was working with Larry at least, and how many more, you know, we don't know, but we know at least he was working with those two at the same time.
Yeah. What's the expression that we have that illustrates that very well? Don't put all your eggs in the same basket. Even in investing, isn't that principle true? Rather than say, well, I think this is a great stock. I'm going to take every penny I have and invest it right here. Well, you might do that, and maybe everything works out great. But there have been some people who did that, and it didn't work out so swell. So you say, this might not be doing very well now. Longer term, it's probably going to get better. At least that's the hope. But right over here, things are going great. So we're going to fare well here. Hopefully, things will turn around over there at a later time. All right, number three, what's the origin of the church as found in Scripture? Ephesians 3:11 says that the church was in God's, anybody remember that key word before purpose? In his eternal purpose. Ephesians 3:11. That sounds pretty important. When somebody says, I've been planning this, I've been thinking about this for a long time. I've been thinking about this, I've invested my lifetime in this. Well, that usually sounds pretty significant. And when God says, the eternal purpose I had in the spiritual realm was the creation of the New Testament church, that screams importance. He asks then, point four, why is it important to know this Bible fact that the church is in the eternal purpose of God? Why is that important? All right, there have been some people who have suggested that the church is an afterthought. God says no. That can't be the case if it is part of my eternal purpose. So it's important to know that. It's a key part of the Bible. The Bible revolves around the church. Old Testament was preparing for it. Jesus comes to talk about it some more, be the head of it. New Testament, Acts through Revelation, tells us a lot about that church, how to be part of it, what's going to happen to it at the end of time, and so forth. Number six, when or where do we think the church was started? Or do they, rather, think the church was started? Talking to this guy in the street, and you say, well, you know, when do you think the church started? What do you suppose would be some answers?
Yeah, 100 different people you ask, you probably have 100 different
answers. I think that's probably right. For a lot of people, they would have never considered that question, and they'll try to come up with the best answer. Well, let's see, John the Baptist, that sounds like a good answer. Or Martin Luther started it. They don't know. And for us, we probably consider that question many, many times over the years and talk to people about it. It's second nature to us. But for a lot of people, that is a brand new thought. Glenda?
A lot of people think it started in the late 1800s with Alexander Campbell.
Sure. Okay, we had Ephesians, I think we had Ephesians 3:11 for that reference. For point three, what's the origin of the church? And then why is it important to know that?
16, or upon with Peter's confession, and with great emphasis on verse 15.
Yeah, that would be, yeah, I'm not saying that Ephesians 3:11 would be the exclusive passage that we would want to use. That was just the one I picked. I should have probably asked if others had some additional references. That would be another great one, going back to Matthew 16. Okay. And then we have Jeff's comment about point four, why is it important? And then we were looking at points five and six, do others know about the origin of the church? Oftentimes, no. And what do we probably find with them when they talk about when or where the church was started? No thought to that. So then we head down to point seven regarding Dr. Cannon's work, relating to his scientific findings, that animals react to threats with a general discharge of the sympathetic nervous system, priming the animal for one of two subsequent responses, fighting or fleeing. How should Christians react to spiritual threats? Let's maybe identify a spiritual threat.
Rejection.
All right, I think that's a really good answer. Rejection might be one of the top answers. Anything else? A spiritual threat.
Power.
All right. Fear. Anxiety. Taking those answers, let's ask again the question. How should Christians react to spiritual threats? What if you're a parent? Several of us have been. Kids are out of the house now, or several of us are. And you have one of those moments where Johnny or Susie comes in and says, hey, Mom or Dad, and I'm not going to fill in the blank here. It might be embarrassing for you. But Johnny or Susie says, what about? And they just lay it out, and your mouth is stretched open. You think, wow, where did that come from? I never expected my child to ask that question. Maybe it's a very embarrassing question, but it's the kind of question that you wish that you would have had some preparation for, and you got none. Why, you kid, you go to the room. I'm not going to talk to you about that. That's probably not the best way to react, is it?
No.
How do you want to deal with that?
Depends on the age of the kid.
Well, okay, let's say that we're dealing with a 12-year-old. Old enough. Old enough where you can't really shoo them away and say, or here's a cookie and we'll talk about it later. I mean, you're on the spot and you're gonna have to deal with this. And you're really feeling like you're on the hot seat.
I think if it's a 12-year-old, that we can start asking them some questions as to what brought up the subject, the topic, what do they think about the topic, how would they handle that with one of their friends that they
Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you two postures. Posture one. Posture two. What do you see as far as the difference in the postures?
Tense.
Yeah, tense, aggressive, defensive. I'm not saying anything. I'm just gripping this thing and holding it for dear life. Do you see the fight or flight reaction? You see both there, don't you? You could say, okay, he's going to come after me now, boy. Or he's afraid and he's grabbed that because it's sort of his security blanket. So as that comes up, when those things are asked of us, whether it's a child that's 12 or 13, or whether it is a spiritual question, do you think the posture we assume can have some bearing on how we deal with the situation? Yeah. It can be significant. So sometimes it's valuable just to take a breath and just step back. That may give you a minute to think about things, and then you might start, if you don't know where to begin, as Ray mentioned, I think that was wise advice, ask a couple more questions. You've been thinking about that long? That come up at school? And it might be that a couple more questions, just kind of crossed the mind. I really don't care about it. Well, okay, if you want to discuss that again, and now it's off the table, at least for that period of time. But when those kinds of circumstances do come up, we do have that flight or fight reaction. And we're called on to do one or the other, and there's a strong temptation. But sometimes we can sort of ratchet that down. We can tone it down a few notches by just, like I say, taking a deep breath and saying, this is not the end of the world, and we'll work through this somehow.
I think what you just said is a good answer or example of a third possibility that I have done some reading about, and that is there's either the fight or the flight, which are the two opposite ends, mm-hmm. or freeze. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not suggesting that's what you're saying to do, but just stop and collect your thoughts, mm-hmm. and then go on. This is a sort of an example of just freezing temporarily.
Yeah, you're pausing to make an evaluation,
right.
Rather than rashly run to this extreme or rashly run to that extreme. And that's that balanced kind of personality that you're hopefully going to find among God's people. So the world isn't going to collapse if you take a minute to collect your thoughts. And what if you said to a person, whether it was a 12-year-old or a person who asked you this religious question out of the blue, and the first thought is, oh, wow, I have no idea how I'm going to answer that. I don't even know where to begin. And could you say, could I pause just a minute and collect my thoughts?
Sure.
I've given this illustration before, but I think it's timely for what we're dealing with here. Pulled in one morning, And, you know, it was kind of one of those frosty mornings, probably in February, and it sounded like a guy was coming in on two wheels behind me. You know, when I saw that behavior, I thought, oh, boy, you know, I wonder who that is. What's going on there? Is he dangerous or crazy? So I looked at him for a minute and got out of the vehicle, and he hopped out, and he said, hey, I want to go to mission work. Will you give me some money? You know, they didn't exactly cover that in my training, and it was, you know, early enough in the morning where I thought, you know, what do I say to the guy? So I didn't have a good answer. So I said, well, tell you what. I said, I'm just getting here. Why don't we turn the lights on? I've got an office back there, and I'm not a coffee drinker, otherwise I could have offered him some coffee. But I said, we'll go back and turn the heat on, and then we can go back and talk. Well, that gave me 3 or 4 minutes to sort of get the mental block unblocked. And by that time, I thought, okay, we can sit down, and if he wants money for mission work, he should be able to teach somebody how to become a Christian. So that's what we did. I said, I'll tell you what, why don't I play the sinner, and you play the preacher? And if you think you're ready to go to the mission field, you show me how to become a Christian. Okay, great. Well, that didn't go so swell for him. But anyway, that allowed me to deal with that situation. I needed a little time to think through something that was brand new to me. And there's nothing wrong with doing that, whether it's a work situation, whether it is a marital situation, we're dealing with kids, and certainly in the spiritual realm. Just, you know, let me collect my thoughts for a little bit, and it's not going to be the end of the world.
With any conversation, if you need to buy time or you don't know how to respond, you need to delve into where it's coming from, like Rick said. You need to ask open-ended questions and see. Once you learn a little bit more information, you know how to cover it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you don't, if there is no context, if there is no semblance of understanding where a person is coming from, your answer, you might get it right. But your answer could be so far off that it's better to say, could you help me understand a little bit more? And I do that sometimes. Can you help me understand your thinking a little bit? I'm not quite sure I'm understanding the background for the question, those kinds of things. Nothing wrong with that. Actually, I would say that shows some intelligence on the part of the person who's being asked. Anybody else? Okay, top of page 29.8, Randall provided the stimulus for Mike to react to his spiritual judgment that he was lost. Randall's response initiated the fight response. He gave him what I would think of as a wake-up call. And when we think about who we are as Christians, that's not a bad way to look at our spiritual identity. That we should be like Randall in that we're trying to be like an alarm clock. We're trying to be like the fire alarm that's going off. We're trying to tell people, there's a problem. What's wrong with you? You're in sin, right? And as long as you stay in that spiritual condition, what's going to happen to you? You're lost. You're going to die outside of Christ. You can't be saved. If that person is going to figure that out, it's likely going to come from one of two ways. Way number one would be, he's going to figure it out himself. He picks up a tract, he hears something, he investigates the Bible. Way number two is what? If he's not figuring it out, then he's going to need some help, and that help is going to come from somebody like us. So he certainly has a shot at figuring things out, but sometimes there needs to be a stimulus, and sometimes that stimulus is us. And we're trying to, I don't know if you'd want to use the word push, but motivate people, stimulate people, encourage people somehow. Now, I think everybody in here knows this as well as I do. When you try to stimulate people to do something, it doesn't always work as you hope. If you're trying to stimulate a child, motivate a child, I've had some parents over the years say, well, I can't get my child to do such and such. Well, I'm not sure that I could do any better because there are some people that are really hard to stimulate. And sometimes you can stimulate some people and the reaction you get is the very opposite of what you want. This, in some respects, goes back to the soil. If you have someone who has a good heart, someone who really wants to do what's right, someone who's serving God, oftentimes you can ask the kinds of questions that we have in our study, and that's going to help the person do what's right. But if you ask these questions of somebody else, a different kind of soil, do you think you might get a different reaction from the stimulation? You tell a person, you're going to hell. How will some people react to that? All right. So remember the fight or flight record. You know, some would just, we're done. Others would want to stand there and fight you. And Carol, you may have had an additional thought. All right, I'm going to expand on that because that takes me where I wanted to go specifically. They get angry. Now, I doubt that Mike was real happy when he heard that. Generally, if a person is told they're going to hell, oh yeah, hey, I'm happy about that. Great. Just made my day. They're probably going to be a bit angry. But some people not only get angry, what happens? They stay angry. And they will take that to the grave. That preacher said, I'm going to hell. And it doesn't even have to be in a one-on-one situation. Ever hear, hopefully it wasn't for me, but have you ever heard from someone who said, I was at this church and this preacher said, and I will never forget it? Anybody ever have that experience? Well, probably at least a third. Now, maybe the preacher said what was right, maybe he didn't, maybe he said what was right and didn't say it in a very good way. Maybe the person was especially sensitive. Who knows what the problem was? But when you come to stimulating people, that needs to be done. But it needs to be done in the right way. And sometimes we're going to get it wrong. And if you're going to try to teach people, that's something that you're going to have them. That's par for the course. But isn't that true of other parts of life as well? Isn't it true in the work world? You have a problem with an employee, and the problem needs to be corrected. What do you have to do to the employee? Unless you're going to tolerate the behavior, you either fire them or you stimulate them. And if you stimulate them, it doesn't always go well. Where else do you see the need for stimulation? What about the neighbor that's not cutting his grass? An eyesore. Doesn't pick up his trash. Leaves the trash can out there for weeks on end. We do need to stimulate people, but again, that is sometimes so difficult. People will sometimes say, well, I don't want to talk to him. Oh, I tried that before. And let me tell you how it went. You go see him if you want to stimulate him. But that is a part of the Christian life. Anything else? Absolutely. Scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, two-fold child of hell, vipers. Well, Jesus probably didn't make too many friends on the days that he used those words. But again, he knew that if people persisted in their spiritual condition, they were going to be lost. So he tried to stimulate them. Now, he had some inside information, so to speak. He knew the best way to approach those people. And for us, sometimes we get it wrong. Hopefully we do a little bit better with friends. And if you're trying to stimulate somebody that you don't know very well, again. But at least at the end of the day, you can say, I tried. And if they didn't take it well, I tried to speak the truth in love. And if they rejected that, then they didn't. It's kind of like in the Old Testament. They've not rejected you when it came to the king. God said, Samuel, they've not rejected you. They've rejected me. And that principle is still true. Doctors do that. Patient comes in, the patient is not cooperating, and the doctor finally says, look, unless you cut your salt, unless you cut your sugar, unless you drop some weight, unless you exercise, whatever it might be, you're going to die. Most people don't want to hear that. It's give me a pill and tell me I'm great and I'm going to, you know, live till I'm 100. And that's tough on docs, but they're trying to stimulate their patients and get paid in the process. Glenda, did you have a thought too? speaking the truth. Speaking the truth in love. Ephesians 4. And if you don't have both of those ingredients, and they're not mixed together in the right combination, it's not going to typically work very well. But if you put those two things together, a person may not like what you said. But I'll guarantee you, they will remember how you said it. Now you take that home with you tonight. Person may not like what you said, and they may remember it for a long time. But they may remember, and they'll admit it. Well, at least he was nice about it. But if you were the guy that was snotty about it, if you were the guy who was hateful about it when you're teaching a class or preaching a sermon or delivering a Bible study, or you were the doctor that was not nice about it. And that's one of the things that helps docs. You know, the doc, I've asked people, when the doc told you that, was he mean? Well, no, he wasn't mean. Do you think he was trying to be unkind? Well, no, he wasn't trying to be unkind. What do you think? Well, he was trying to help me out. Okay, so you don't dispute the facts, do you? Well, no. It's just you don't like the facts. Well, yeah, that's it. And if people are allowed to think through that, they'll realize that the problem is not with him, the problem is with me. And that's true spiritually.
I don't know if this belongs in this conversation or not, but I think most of us are, or a lot of us are familiar with this situation in the physical world. Anybody that's ever had to deal with a rusty bolt has dealt with the same situation. You put the wrench on it to start with, and you try, and it doesn't move. Maybe you get a bigger wrench, still doesn't move. But you're being, at that point in time, usually if you first start, you're being patient, and you're working with it. So you go get some liquid wrench or some oil or whatever, and you put that on it, and you see if that'll work. And it still doesn't work. Well, you can do a couple of things. You can be patient, and you can wait a week, let it soak, and then try it again. Or you can maybe, depending on the situation, you realize it's not going to work. You go get the blowtorch, and you apply the heat.
Yeah.
But if you do that, you also have to recognize that two things can happen. One, it'll break loose, and you'll be where you want to be, or you'll twist the bolt off.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that we readily recognize, that situation.
There are several great parallels between the real world and the spiritual realm, and that's another one. You know, we might be patient for a little while, and we think, well, okay, he's had his 2 weeks, and he's still pretty stubborn, so here comes the blowtorch, and that'll go ahead and gas him enough to head him in the right direction. Well, he's probably going to go in one direction. It may not be the right one, though. But there is that temptation sometimes, and people will blow a study for that very reason. Number 9, was this a good thing or was it a bad thing? It was a good thing. He did become a Christian, right? So I think that would be how we'd want to answer that. Number 10.
What about politically correctness in this world today?
Yeah, well, you can't have that.
No.
If you're trying to stimulate people. Did you see the comment? Was it by Chavez? He talked about healthcare and iPhones. He said you might have to choose between the new iPhone. He was very specific. You might have to choose between the new iPhone and healthcare. And people jumped all over that. So, you know, people have their ideas as far as, well, you know, people need to be able to have this or that or the other thing. Don't say this to them. Don't say that to them. And if it doesn't line up with what they think that they should have or their beliefs and so forth, I mean, they just go wacko. And that was one example of that. He didn't say people shouldn't have a smartphone or this, that, or the other thing, but it was the latest and greatest. And I just found that interesting that they disregarded actually what he said and inserted their own stuff there. But that's what people will do. If they don't hear what they want to hear, they will go out and start saying things that you didn't say. They'll take a form of that. But if you're going to quote me and you're going to fault me, okay, but at least fault me for what I said. Don't take 70% of what I said and start switching this around and that around, and then all of a sudden, well, you know, we're upset because he said that. No, I said something that had some of those same words, but I didn't say what you're claiming. And yet, in our world, that is oftentimes what we struggle with. Anybody else? Okay, let's look at point 10. How should, quote unquote, the Christian respond when a person's fight mechanism is stimulated by the teaching? He says, provide two scriptures that confirm your conclusion. Anybody write down a couple verses? Well, here are the two that I chose. Ephesians 4:15. Once again, speak the truth in love. And I think that's a very good passage. Speak the truth in love, Ephesians 4:15. Then another one, this will be two verses long, 2 Timothy chapter 2, verses 24 and 25. Paul said, the Lord's servant must not strive, but be gentle towards all, apt to teach. And there stands blowtorch illustration. You know, not strive, don't apply the heat to the point where you're going to have one of two extreme reactions, but you're continuing to apply pressure little by little. And finally, if that bolt's not going to come loose, you may have to say, today's it. I've done everything I know. It's soaked for a month. It will not come loose. And now we're going to apply this last expression of pressure and see if it finally doesn't come. And it's going to go one way or the other. But I don't have any choice. I've exhausted all the other options. And sometimes that's what we get with people as well. 11 and 12, in your opinion from this chapter, what was the most important thing that Randall did that caused Mr. Mike to decide to search the scriptures for himself? You are going to hell. That was the answer that I came up with that.
He stood his ground.
Well, he did. You know, you're lost. And you know, this is what God says, and you're not in the right relationship with him. And then also, I think you could add in there possibly the tracks. He apparently had some assistance in making sure that Mike had access to them as well. Stan?
Back to number 10. In this one, I think Randall shows frequently, maybe not so much this particular time, although I wouldn't say also at this time, but that is a soft word, turn away wrath.
Yes.
He doesn't allow himself to ever get heated up or argumentative or whatever. He keeps his demeanor appropriate for his approach.
Yeah. People excel at justifying why they will not do something that's right. And if you get mad in a Bible study, they're not going to dispute the facts as far as what the Bible says. Why, he raised his voice. He shook his finger at me. He kicked me under the table. Well, who knows what it might be. But they're going to say something that's not related to the study. They're going to put the blame on you. And that's where the onus is. It's not, this is what the Bible taught. So, ideally, as you're talking with people, you want to, regardless of what they believe about Scripture and the conclusions that are offered from God's Word, you want to make sure that you don't hopefully do anything that interferes with that. If they're going to reject it, let it be they reject God and His Word. They don't reject it because of you. Glenda? Okay, as far as a person's fight mechanism, when that's stimulated, how should a Christian respond?
And then Stephen.
Yeah. Yeah, you have various things there. For example, if you go back to Paul, assuming that he was mocked in that case, derision, when that happens, it's always frustrating. People make fun of you, but that's going to test you, going to see what you're made of and how you're going to respond. And as you said, you also have other cases. Stephen will be one that you mentioned back in Acts chapter 7. If you're attacked, if you're hit, how are you going to respond? In this case, he was stoned, and the stoning ended up taking his life. And yet, there's nothing that they can do. They can't attack the teaching. I mean, that was from God. They certainly can't attack the man, because he's not out there trying to club him to death or anything like that. So, yes, very, very powerful testimony as far as how he died and what he taught.
I wrote down instances rather than scriptures.
That works. Anybody else? Okay, let's pick up number 12, and I think that'll run us out of time tonight. What verse did Randall quote as Mike walked away? I pulled from chapter 8. I took a different verse. That may be what he was after. I took 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 3. In 2 Peter 2, 3, and then Glenda, we can have that reference that you cited used as well. 2 Peter 2, 3 says, they make merchandise of you, of your soul. When you have a verse like that, does that get your attention? It'd be like somebody saying, hey, he took advantage of you. You're going to pay attention to that? Most people will, because it sounds like I've been conned. You know that I was taken. Brenda, that verse you have?
Yeah.